You are listening to another Screenfish One-on-One, this time live with actor-director Edward Norton. Norton returns to the directing chair with Motherless Brooklyn. Set in 1950s New York, Motherless Brooklyn tells the story of Lionel, a private detective afflicted with Tourette syndrome who tries to solve the murder of his mentor. In the process, he unravels a web of corruption that may lead all the way to the top of New York City's political system. In this one-on-one, we get to speak to Norton about what it is about power that often leads to corruption, what it means to present mental illness on screen, and the vibrancy of New York City. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Hi, Edward. How are you? Oh, it is such a privilege to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Not at all. Thanks for covering our Tourette detective film.
I saw it at the film festival, and I really thought it was brilliant. I absolutely loved the film.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I was wondering what it is about this particular story. I know it's taken you a while to get it on screen. I think I heard as long as 20 years. And what was it about this story that made you want to bring it to the screen?
The character was entirely the initial hook for me. The many things that got woven into it to sort of expand on its scope, or, you know, the broader targets that it had ultimately were not where I was within its beginning. I just was completely enamored of this character Jonathan Lethem created, and not just like because he's a unique and character with a unique condition, and the idea of sending him, a person with those mental gifts and challenges, put up against the idea of solving mysteries is just sort of fun. It's that also Jonathan's emotional hook is brilliant. It's exactly what we poached and transposed in the film. You hear his inner voice from the opening page. You're inside his head. You know him, you know him free of his condition. You know his inner mind, his inner heart, and then you see him on the outside. He's got this hot mess of kicks and twitches and shouts, and watching him have to navigate that is funny and poignant. And that's all on before the end of page two. You know what I mean? You're there. You're rooting for him. He's a great underdog character. You're laughing, you're wincing, and you're sort of like, wherever this guy's going, it's going to be fun, because watching him navigate this is itself the pleasure, right? And that was the entirety of my initial interest in it.
It is true what you said there. He's funny, he's poignant, he's lovable. You can tell he's frustrated. Like, there's so many things going on within his character. And one of the things about him I think is so interesting is, of course, his mental health issues and how they're portrayed on screen. And you've played characters with mental health issues before. I was wondering how you prepare for that role. What have you learned through that process?
I'm trying to think if I have played characters with authentic mental health issues. I've played characters who are faking.
That's true. Primal Fear.
Primal Fear, he's faking. In the score, it's not a mental health issue. He's approximating someone with, like, cerebral palsy, right? A physical disability, but he's faking too. I guess you could say that the character in Fight Club has mental health issues, but you don't really know that.
right, of course.
Until the end. It's not until the end that you realize he might be schizophrenic.
Right.
So I actually think arguably this is the first time I've played a character with an authentic clinical condition, psychological condition, and I don't know that there's kind of a it's not a reductive, like, how do you approach it? It's you find your way. You know, there are documentaries about people with Tourette's and OCD. I've met some. You talk to people. For me, honestly, because Tourette's syndrome has many components, and it can be expressed in people in very individualistic ways. Some people have physical tics, some don't. Some people have vocal tics, some don't. Some people have full-blown echolalia, the impulse to shout things, and sometimes inappropriate things. Some people have an obsessive compulsive behavioral component, some don't at all, you know? And so it's like what I set myself out to do was find out what are credible sort of symptomatic pieces of it, and then build my own basket of them for Lionel, so that you could create a weave of consistent things like his compulsion to tap people that he feels close with, or his compulsion, the idea of having a single word in his case, if, that he says over and over, that's something, you know, and then just to build so that you have the weave of what's his authentic version of it, and then, you know, structure that into the story so that it has times, like he says, it can be kind of modestly under control or it can get really bad. But I don't actually tend to think that representing physical manifestations of a thing are the hardest thing or the most important challenge. I think the bigger thing is not reducing any kind of disability to the whole of that person's character. You know, that I think if there's anything people I've talked to say really drives them nuts, it's when it's made all about the disability, right? Obviously, in this, a huge part of this is Lionel's love for Frank. It's his sense of being motherless. It's as much about the fact that he has never been a person who, as he says, looks past his own problems to kind of concern himself with the rest of the world, you know?
Yeah.
And that he's got to grow up, you know, like anybody else. And that's why I think, in a funny way, like, a condition can be a part of the mechanism of an audience's empathy. But what I think is really cool is when, to Laura, it's like, sure, but it's not everything. It does, you know, everybody's got something, you know, and she says it kindly. She says, hey, you know, we've all got daily battles, right? And, you know, and it really pulls him up short. Like, suddenly someone's looking at him and not seeing him just for that. They're saying, sure, but that's just a part of life, right? And from that point forward, I think he's confronting what's his next chapter going to be post Frank. Is he going to get pulled into the dark side by Moses Randolph, or is he going to sort of take up the mantle of Laura and Paul and care about other people? You know what I mean? It's like he's got to grow up.
Lionel takes his name from the city itself, or rather, it's given to him by Frank, calling him Motherless Brooklyn. Because the city is almost a character in the film of itself, do you feel there's comparisons there? Like, what is it about that name that works with his character as well?
Well, it's not just the name. I think it's the whole title, Motherless Brooklyn. I think it's that idea that it's what Laura says. We, you know, we all need someone looking out for us. And I think the idea of whether on an individual level, it's a very lonely condition to not have anyone caring for you. They both have father figures. They both lose them. They kind of recover that sense of maybe someone to find shelter with or find a place in the world with each other. They you know, there's potential between them of caring for each other. But I think, too, it's what Laura says. It's like, she's like, look, you know, you'd think someone would care about what's going on to Brooklyn. It's the biggest city on earth. You know what I mean? It's like, some people said to me, why are you going to spend the money? Why are you going to break your back trying to figure out on a budget how to effectively recreate Penn Station? And it is kind of tilting at windmills, but it's not nothing. It's like that's the macro scale. You know, the micro scale is it's lonely and sad and hard to be alone in the world, right? And people need each other, take care of each other. But on the macro, it's like if our city is motherless, we lose Penn Station. You know what I mean? We lose things that we'll never get back. We lose communities. We lose some of the richest, most diverse communities in Brooklyn get replaced with the worst ghettos in the world, the projects, right? You know, like literally, they literally took stable places, called them slums, ripped them down, and put up slums. You know what I mean? And there's like aesthetic loss. You lose the things that make a place great, like Penn Station. And to me, it was like, you got to see the ghost of what we lost to make the subconscious point. These are the costs of aligning ourselves or allowing power tell us all to get out of the way. You know what I mean? It's like anything good. I think if it resonates on multiple levels, then that's great.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the idea of power, because the film's very much about the corruption of power. I think at one point Alec actually says, power is knowing that you can do whatever you want and no one can stop you. Why is it that you think power is so dangerous? And is it always? You know, the line says that absolute power corrupts absolutely.
I think that Willem's character gets at it when he says he was so, talking about his brother being an idealist and them having a creed and they were going to fix the world together. And he says, but he was so brilliant that he resented lesser minds. The idea that other people are an inconvenience, when he says to serve people, you got to love people. Like, I think that part of what creates the drive for power in some people is impatience with other human beings, you know, and a lack of authentic affection for other human beings. And I think we're in an era where we're seeing it expressed in a new resurgence of a very nativist, very exclusionary idea of, like, what America is. It's not only antagonistic to our actual ideals, but antagonistic to our whole history. That's what's so crazy about it. It's like this romance for a thing that never existed in the first place. You know what I mean? But it's like what my friend, who is Mexican, said, you know, this is the Latin American jefe problem, the dictator problem. It's like there's something base in us that responds to the audacity of someone saying, I'm going to punch through the inefficiency of us having to all work together and just get shit done, you know? And it's like some part of us goes, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it's an almost tribal kind of a thing and it's amazing in 2019 that we're actually still grappling with the idea that under the right circumstances, people will elevate a bully, you know, just a bully. But I don't, honestly, there's that, but that sounds like the focus is on, like, very immediate contemporary things. I think the thing that is much more specific is the idea that what I was trying to look at is the idea that in America, we're supposed to know where the power is. It's with us. Right? That's where it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to reside in places that we not only didn't assign it, but that we don't even know. We don't even realize that it has become outside of our purview. You know what I mean? And that's what Willem's saying is, when things are not seen, when where the power is unseen, that's a truly dangerous situation, because we're walking around in a democracy like Hindu cows thinking everything's okay, and we believe in the system, and we don't realize that there are forces dictating what's really happening that do not have our best interests in mind, and that's the most dangerous situation. And to me, that's as much about, like, the Koch brothers as it is about Trump.
Right.
Trump's pretty naked. The darker idea is that, like, there's a mayor being inaugurated and he is completely irrelevant, and that we're about to learn that the guy impatiently looking at his watch in the shadow of a column whose face we can't see and haven't seen through the whole sequence of his introduction is the one who calls all of the shots. And I think whether you want to ascribe it to Citizens United or an intrinsic part of American life and capitalism, that enormous amounts of power get amassed outside of the political system, and to the degree that they own the political system or are evading the political system, that's what Ralph Nader rightly said is the great challenge of democracy will be whether people can retain the priority of human interest over, you know, corporate interest, he would say, but the interest of power, basically.
As we start to wrap up, maybe we could talk a little bit about music in the film. The use of jazz is just beautiful, and actually there's a really beautiful scene where it even compares, where Brooklyn's Tourette's is actually drawn into the jazz itself and brought into the music. And I was wondering why jazz was so important to you for this film, and why you felt you could represent Lionel's mental health in that way.
I think jazz has a very Tourette-ic characteristic. Certainly bop and hard bop, you know, there's the idea of looping around, playing with variations on a theme, the kind of exuberant release that is in jazz is like, you know, and there's a great passage in the book about Prince's music, but obviously we weren't going to do that. So to me, the idea, rather than a narration about music, just a scene where you see and feel for once Lionel kind of losing his happily losing his inhibition and finding a moment of poetic liberation in it was a neat idea. I liked that idea. And I liked the idea that he finds an affinity with a Charlie Parker, a Dizzy Gillespie, kind of a Miles Davis-y kind of a figure, you know, who sees him, you know?
Yeah. Honestly, thank you, Edward. I really, truly mean this. It is just a wonderful film. It's a lot of fun, you know, with shades of Chinatown in there and so many other great film noir. I really appreciate you chatting with me. Thank you so much.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for the question.
All right, have a great day.
Thanks.